great work is difficult, and anyone who tells you it isn't is lying. It's often stuff that hasn't been done before. If you both know we're pointing in the same direction, then everything else is just detail, and you can get over it, and you can create that bit of magic.
Hello, and welcome to episode 69 of the Entrepreneur Experiment Podcast with me, Gary Fox. This week, I'm chatting to Pat Stevenson, the founder of Boys and Girls. This was like sitting down with a very old friend of mine, even though I'd never met Pat before in my life. Pat is something of a kindred spirit, and just sometimes you click with someone and I get massive value from those chats. And it was really a pleasure to sit down with Pat. I also think you're going to get massive value from this. Pat's going to teach us three main things today. Number one, why doing great work should be difficult. Number two, he's going to share practical tips on how to start your own business and also a design agency. And the most practical of all, how to get your very first client. And number three, how they landed the biggest deal of their history with Chelsea Football Club. This is my chat with Pat Stevenson, the founder of Boys and Girls. Pat, welcome to the pod.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's great. And it's my second in-person pod since COVID.
Well, listen, I'm here to please.
And we're sitting in a very fancy pod as well.
Yeah,
pod in a pod.
We are pod in a pod. Yeah. Who knew? No, it's great to be able to talk in person. And I'm finding that Zoom is brilliant and a fantastic thing when you can't meet in person, but it really doesn't replicate that eye to eye feeling for someone.
Yeah, same. I give everyone now obviously the choice of going, do you want to do it by Zoom or do you want to do it by in person? Secretly, I'm like, please do it in person, because the difference, yeah, just that feeling, just like literally we had a chat before this, we had a coffee, especially when, you know, you don't know the person for a long time. It's great just to, how are you feeling working from remotely? How's that been for you guys?
So I think working remotely has gone remarkably well. You know, it's something that we've been looking at for a while. I think some of us were more keen on it than others. But when you had to do it, obviously, you know, we had no choice about it. It's gone really, really well. So like we've done things we didn't think were possible. So working on really large creative projects or pitch proposals for clients you've never met, and everything's done from briefing through to final execution, all done online. The one thing I think that has been more difficult than others is just trying to keep that sense of kind of cultural continuity or community going. So it's funny, we had a socially distanced summer party out in our car park, you know, cans and 2 meters apart and stuff, but it was I've never seen people so happy in all their lives to be able to work function. It's just, you know, especially in our business, you know, people are almost everything, and people get a real genuine, tangible buzz off being around each other. So we're looking forward to trying to get back into the office in a limited capacity, just to try and keep that going, you know?
Sorry, I should ask you, what do you guys do?
Oh!
we jumped right in there. I didn't even, wait, people don't even know what he does.
I'm a founder of an agency called Boys and Girls, based in Dublin, and we're a branded entertainment agency. We create work for ambitious clients. So we believe that branded entertainment is the best way for you to kind of unleash the proper commercial benefits of creativity.
Mm. So what kind of, when you say entertainment, what does that encompass?
Well, I suppose if I take a step back for a second, when we set up the agency, we used to call ourselves a creative agency, and it's still a term we would use this day. And for the most part, what we were asked to do was to produce what is called advertising. Now, advertising has kind of got this kind of, it's like a dirty word or something like that, but essentially, you know, advertising is you creating a message that's trying to make it easier for someone to remember your product and to buy your product. When we talk about entertainment, we're talking about something that has got inherent quality baked into it. So the problem, I think, in terms of why a lot of people are irritated with advertising and why, you know, ad blocking is essentially the biggest global boycott in history, is that advertising is just an invitation for you to give someone a message. And people think, you know, it's like being invited to a dinner party and just boring people to death, right? You know, you're invited to a dinner party, you need to entertain, you need to, you know, like earn your right to be there. And advertising is just the same. So the simple way that we've thought about it is that if you can come up with whatever that compelling, you know, message for your product or services and just deliver it in the most entertaining way possible, people will, or A, more likely to remember it, you know, and B, might even seek it out. So it's going to cost you less to get that message over there, and it'll have a much better result.
So how did you guys start?
So we started back in the depths of 2009. We set up the agency. We sort of got together in September 2009 and officially opened our doors to our no clients in late October, November. And I suppose like there was six of us at that stage when we opened the doors, and we were just like a group of like-minded people. We saw, or we felt there was an opportunity for an agency to be out there producing a better quality work. And that was really what we aligned around. Obviously there was a recession going on at that time, and that for us felt like a good opportunity to set up a business. Recession is always a great time for a business to set up, because, you know, costs are low, the opportunity cost is relatively low. And it was just something that, it was an itch that we needed to scratch as individuals and then as a collective.
Were you friends, colleagues? How did you, you said there were six of you, that's quite a lot to start a business with.
Yeah, it was. It was a mix of us. So if I take, say, Rory, who's our creative director, you know, I'd lived with his sister for 4 years in and around college, and he just hung around the place. And then we ended up working an agency together, and we said, you know, wouldn't this be a great thing to do? And, you know, it was actually one of those conversations over a pint that ended up turning into a real one. And then, you know, the likes of, say, Patrick, Chris, Margaret, you know, we'd worked with each other over the years. So, yeah, it was a coming together at the right time of the right people. And I think we felt as well that amongst the six was, we had enough experience in enough sectors and knew enough people that if someone was to give us an opportunity, that we could take it and deliver the work. So we were maybe less of a risk than, say, a two-man outfit that just set up under the stairs.
Okay, so you felt like you had all the skills covered. And how, you said you started with no clients. When I put up on social media, you were coming on, we got a lot of questions in. And one from Fiona was, how do you get your first clients? You've just set up your agency, you're sitting there looking at each other. How do you get that first client, that elusive first client?
Okay, so I tell a lie. We had Margaret, who looks after planning and strategy in the agency, she had been working with Danone on a strategic basis for years, and as she continues to, I won't tell you how long she's been working with them. So we had them from a strategic perspective, but they've always kind of remained kind of outside of the main agency. But how do you get your first client? Well, you do what you do in any business, which is you try and activate your network. So my job at the start, and we all had kind of different roles, was to go to the opening of the crisp packet, right? So meet everyone I'd ever met for coffee, and you know, try and meet all of your old clients, obviously, or people in related industries. Go to all of the various events that you're supposed to go to, most of which are useless, the networking events and all that kind of stuff. And eventually you will get an opportunity. So I think weirdly we managed to secure through our very brilliant PR man David O'Brien a good bit of PR coverage, and we got a couple of people contact us because the name was maybe a bit funny, or
name is great.
And my sideburns at the time were ginormous, and I think that was possibly
that was your branding.
That was our branding, yeah. No, well, I think look, there hadn't been a new agency launch for quite a while, and we were kind of bright and young and a bit effervescent. So, sorry. The other important thing was we took the decision that when we were opening the offices, so we were in an old chartered accountant's office in Pembroke Road. So we didn't have very much money, so we painted stuff ourselves, ripped up the carpet. But we felt like we needed to have something that kind of signaled a creative space. And, you know, working with Rory, he came up with the idea of using Lego as kind of a calling card. So we worked with these guys called ABGC, and we built a Lego boardroom table. And
oh,
actually,
yes. So I think I've seen this online, actually. I've seen this online.
Yeah, so we created a video for our Lego boardroom table, and you know, if you don't have any clients, you've got plenty of time to make stuff like that and make the video. And actually, just it, that blew up, right? So we probably could have sold a lot of Lego tables.
Yeah.
You know, I know you talk in one of your other podcasts about, you know, deciding what your business is after 5 weeks, right? Well, we could have sold a lot of Lego tables after 5 weeks. But so having that is kind of a, I think it's really important for every business to have something that kind of creates a little bit of a memory structure. So the Lego table for us just gave people something a little bit distinctive for them to remember us as an agency. So Boys and Girls as an Agency, oh, they're the ones with the Lego table.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
You need that hook, don't you?
You need something.
He's the guy with the sideburns. They're the guy with the Lego table.
Yeah. The sideburns, I should point out, were ridiculous and terrible. I've tried to remove them from the internet.
But like people always say, I get people messaging me going, oh, I've just started a new business. How do I get PR coverage? I'm like, what's interesting about it?
Yeah.
Because those are businesses start every day and it's often the hook.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, Pat's into skydiving, Gary's into MMA. What is it?
We tried everything, right? So like we wanted to make sure, I suppose we'd read all the books and, you know, in particular stuff like say Eat the Big Fish, Adam Morgan. And at the time, I think just after we launched Baked In came out. I suppose the principles of those books is that you try and make sure that every customer facing asset is maximized, you know, that it communicates something about your business. So for us, we didn't have an advertising budget. You know, we were doing some PR, which David very kindly did for us. And then, you know, what else do you have? So you walk in the door, you need to make an impression. And the Lego table for us was that. But we tried other things. We had bake fresh scones for every client, which we did for the first. Yeah, well, like so there was, and we felt like little touches. So and
yeah.
I think that's one of the things that the agency has been quite good at, even to this day, is trying to mark little occasions. So like if a client has a success in awards, you know, we'll send them a sausage roll or we're sending an ice cream truck over or what, like, and I guess all of this stuff can sound like frippery, but actually for us, it does two things. The most important is it just signifies the truth, which is we're thinking about our clients almost all the time. And two, that we really feel like we share in their successes and we want to kind of mark that. And, you know, it's those are things that are really easy when you're looking at a balance sheet to kind of remove, like, oh, we could save X amount on sending birthday cakes, whatever else. But for us, you know, those things are really important.
I love that. It shows you care as well. And just that surprise and delight, that little moment where you're like, oh, that's so cool. Isn't that cool? Look at this.
Yeah.
That little moment. It's because they're so hard, you know, you very rarely get surprised nowadays.
Yeah.
You very rarely go, oh, wow.
Yeah.
So when something, especially when physical arrives, it's, my God, Amazon deliveries kept me going during lockdown.
Yeah.
Just a little spark of endorphins when something arrives.
Just still something like even last week, I got this lovely little package. Well, sorry, it was a brown envelope. Not one of those ones.
Not one of those.
Through the door. And it was this cocktail in a bag from the 12th Hotel in Galway. And I was like, someone I worked with sent it to me as a kind of a gift. And I was like, this is just such a brilliant idea and a gift and piece of marketing. And if I'm ever down there, I am going to stay there and all those things. Yeah.
It's little things.
Yeah.
It's the little things. People are always looking for that. I think we talked about this earlier about the magic bullet. What's the little? Yeah. Pat, give us the secret. Give us the secret for the agency. And it's the little things.
Yeah,
doing the little things every day and doing them for 5, 10, 15 years.
And sweating everything. So again, as an agency, we are probably our own worst enemy in terms of just wanting to maximize every brief and every opportunity to try and make the best work that we can. Because fundamentally we think if we look after that, if we make sure that the work is good, good work fixes almost everything. Good work fixes commercials, it fixes relationships, it just fixes everything. So, you know, the organization is pretty simple in its cultural formation. We are just always trying to push each other and the clients that we have, you know, great relationships with, to just keep making better work because it's better for their business, which will end up being better for our business.
I find that interesting. You talk about culture quite a bit and you can see it's natural. It's who you guys are. I often hear of like companies that kind of retrofit culture, especially let's say in the tech industry, you know,
would you like to have some fun?
Yeah, stuff. Yeah. Oh, she's the head of fun. And it's just like, you know, retrofitting it never works.
Yeah.
Because you either have it and you live it and you breathe it every single day. It's fine having a culture Friday or whatever, but if you're not living it every day, especially I'd imagine in a service business, it goes sideways very fast.
Yeah, it is. It's like, culture is one of those, it's one of those awful words,
yeah.
You know, it's so amorphous and it doesn't really mean anything, but it feels like something, you know, and I think you can tell so much about an organization if it's got a physical building. When you walk into the reception, you see the pace of people moving or how they're interacting or whatever else. You can feel that kind of energy off it. And, you know, I don't know how you would go about retrofitting it, because so much of it comes from, I suppose, the people that have set up their company and how they behave and how they interact. And that becomes, you know, almost like a way of working in and of itself, which for some of my colleagues is unfortunate, given I walk around singing to myself. Yeah. Sometimes wearing shoes, sometimes not. I don't know, but you know, like,
yes, you are who you are. That's
it. Like, you know, and that's why, well, that's not what, one of the reasons I love working in this industry is, you know, you just get to, be yourself and you have outlets for your creativity. And as a frustrated copywriter, that's great.
Was that why you wanted to set up your own business? Was that the driving force?
The driving force of me setting up my own business was manyfold. I absolutely love what I do. I love advertising. I love working with someone who is invested in their business, trying to understand their business. You know, you'll never understand as well as they will, but trying to understand their business really well, getting in under the skin of it. You know, it doesn't matter if it's making sausages or selling mobile phones, getting into the heart of the business and really understanding how it ticks from how the product or service might be made or serviced or delivered, through to, you know, the political machinations of the organization, because that's important for how you sell it. And then to come up with a means by which you can dramatize a benefit that they mightn't have even seen of themselves, and to bring that to the marketplace in a really interesting or beneficial way. Oh, it's like, and every time you work with a new client, you got a new job. It's the best job in the world, you know?
You clearly seem like you've such a natural sense of kind of curiosity and joy out of it though. But how do you do that? How do you, let's talk me through, okay, we're going after a client or we've just got a new client. How do you get under the skin of a business you don't actually fundamentally work in day to day?
Well, you try and work in their day to day. So like, you know, what we try and do, and obviously, you know, this is going to be a tougher one with COVID, but what you're really trying to do is to spend time in an organization. So like, if you win a piece of business, we would always try and spend time in there. If there's a call center, spend time in the call center. You want to try and literally get inside the business and see what it is, but that isn't always practical or possible. So failing that, you need to spend as much time with, say, the core marketing team or the business owners or else, you know, just talking to them, getting to know them, getting to understand, you know, how their business works, what the priorities are. It's, there's no shortcut to that. And that's why, like, it's very rare, though not impossible, that, you know, when you start working with the client, you're going to hit your very best work out of the park in the first thing. Like, it, you know, I think our track record is really good in terms of, say, the first ads we produce for clients, but almost always our better work or the best work comes from when we know each other, when we're in a kind of a groove where we understand their business, and where really importantly there's that kind of question of alignment, partnership and trust, because great work is difficult. And anyone who tells you it isn't is lying, because it's often stuff that hasn't been done before. But if you've got that amazing sense of alignment and chemistry, you know, and trust with the client, well then, you know, if you both know we're pointing in the same direction, then everything else is just detail and you can get over it and you can create that bit of magic.
Hard though, because there's such a, especially now, there's such an urgency, a demand for immediacy in everything we do.
Yes, it is hard, but I think what you're trying to do is you're always going to have stuff that just needs to get out the gate. But I think you have to have that sense of understanding about the business and the personality you're dealing with. Otherwise, I think you're in danger of just producing work for work's sake or work that is just going to be ignored. And I mean, what's the point in that?
Does that come from having confidence in yourself and your work, though? Being able to say, you know what, guys, that's not right. We need to hold on this and just work on it a little bit more.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I think one of the great failings, I think, of the industry is that sometimes if I look around at some of the work that's being produced, you can see that it's been sliced. Like, there's a good idea, or there was a good idea trying to get out at some stage, and it's been, you know, either hacked to death or softened to death, you know, killed with a pillow because people haven't protected enough. And I think often that's because there's a lot of agencies that don't actually fundamentally believe that what they do is of commercial benefit. And we fundamentally believe that when we produce great work, great creative work that engages in culture and society, that it's delivering massively from the commercial perspective. So we will, of course, put our hands up. And also, I think it's beholden on us as, let's say, my role previously as a business director when I'm working, you know, day-to-day on client stuff, to say, no, that isn't good enough, or that's not right, or it's not right because, and be polite about it, of course. Because otherwise, what are you? You're just, you know, a factory, you know, taking in thoughts, making some stuff and throwing it out. No, you need to, the value is in understanding what needs to be said and saying it brilliantly.
That's beautiful. We're only 20 minutes in. I'm writing furiously here with all the little notes. Has it got harder? Has it got harder in the last, say, since you started to break through the mass of just Larry Chan? I made him on over coffee about this, breaking through the mass of social media and the mass of noise that's out there at the minute. Has it got harder to create beautiful work that stands out?
I'd look at it from the other way around, which is when you produce beautiful work, it stands out even more because of the morass, right? A campaign we started with Three about 2 years ago, and it's run for a couple of years, and it's kind of on hiatus just because of, well, there's no music out there at the moment, but they're made by music work for Three. You know, they've been involved in kind of music sponsorship at the Three Arena and the festivals for years. And what we were working with them was to try and come up with something that was kind of meaningful and played a part in culture that could kind of combine all of their, you know, music properties together. And came up with a relatively simple platform of made by music. But the bit that's really resonated is, rather than creating advertising, what we did was we created music videos for tracks and then turned them into adverts. So we really pushed the boat creatively, giving full license to musicians and directors and stuff to kind of do the best they could. All they had to do was to kind of bake in the fundaments of our made by music message. And we gave them free rein and literally just branded the end. But the work was of such quality that it ended up, as I said earlier on, when it's really good, people seek it out. So we made the music videos, we made the ads in the back of them, and they were so effective. They actually were the YouTube's most globally effective advertising campaign ever, which was something, you know, wasn't a result we were ever looking to achieve at the start. But because the quality was there and you could see in every detail, it was just beautiful looking and really resonated. It ended up smashing the metrics beside. Like, I think, well, I won't name the competitor, but they were looking to beat a competitor's brand association music within 2 years, and they did it in 6 weeks. You know, so like,
wow.
Now obviously that's a bit of a home run and it was a bit of fruit, but it was, you know, we had a great relationship with the client. We sat down really early in YouTube at the stage and said, look, what works here, what doesn't? And we tried to understand what was best of that. And then we ignored a small part of those and just really pushed the boat out. And we're constantly trying to evolve the work as it was going through. And it was just, yeah, it was brilliant. Great piece of work. And it just really stood out because of that entertaining quality.
Take me back to 2009 when you started. I think people are feeling a lot of parallels between then and now in terms of a lot of people are now looking, going, what do I want to do? You know, they might have been laid off, or they might have been, you know what, I actually don't enjoy going to an office 9 to 5, or I want to do my own creative thing. When you started off, bring me through the first, can I say, 6 to 12 months.
Okay, so
this is always the best part. This is the bit I enjoy. The dirty, the hard part.
Okay, so I left my job, I think, I had him on notice in late July, left in early September, found out my wife was pregnant, I think late August, early September, and then find out she was having twins late on that month. So
ship had sailed. You'd already the ship started had sailed.
You know, like, are you sure you want to leave this secure? Anyway, and so I was entering the start of this new company with I suppose a sense of excitement, what I would call naive optimism, because I just genuinely believed it would work, but also really strong impetus for it to succeed. So look, we launched the business, and I'm saying, you know, myself and Patrick ended up having not babies together, but he had his first kid that year as well. So like we were kind of in similar mindsets. We felt that this would work. We needed it to work. And as I said to you, in that first year, it was a question of just trying to meet as many people as possible. And we felt if we had an opportunity, we converted. And like we were delighted to get opportunities with, you know, early doors. We got a brief to do some experiential work, a pitch for experiential work for Irish Distillers. And we got in the door with them on Powers Whiskey, and they asked us to look after the account, and we did some really good work with them. And then you get another opportunity in an organization. And it was really just finding those little avenues of opportunity whereby we felt we could convert because we believed in ourselves. And we were lucky. We knew fundamentally the most difficult thing would be to get someone to take a punt on you. And then ideally for maybe two or three people to take a punt on you. Well, it's the first client that's really being the boldest and the bravest. Like, who are these people? Yeah. Boys and girls, look at his sideburns.
Was that hard though? Because I think self-belief is the number one thing that holds back most entrepreneurs, I think. Is that little, do I believe in what I'm saying here? Why should someone buy off me? How did you clearly have that inherently, but how did you kind of bypass that first client bias whereby, you know, take that punt?
Well, I think we were able to lean on the fact that, as I said, amongst the six of us, we'd worked on, you know, ginormous campaigns for, I think we worked at the time, it was like sort of 43 out of the top 50 brands in Ireland. So we had like a really good pedigree to lean on, and we would kind of push on that. And people knew us from having worked in large agencies beforehand. And I think there was an element of kind of trust that had built up over time in that. And then to your point about self-belief, you know, like I don't think anyone is kind of wholly confident in every aspect of their lives, but we really believed that we could produce great work. And then I was lucky enough to surround myself by people who were really talented, and, you know, I could just, you know, try and open the door for those opportunities and help sell them.
And the first, you know, you got your first couple of clients, you clearly over-delivered. You clearly went and go, right, we're going to over-deliver on what we're doing here.
Yeah, as a trait, again, a cultural kind of trait, we've always tended to over-deliver, to try and present, you know, if you give us a brief for, I don't know, a social campaign, well, we're terrible at presenting an answer for that, but also going, what about this? You know, what about making a book, or what about making, you know, this? And I think that was there right at the start of that. So, yeah, that's always been kind of there with us. We're always trying to, if we come up with a really good idea, trying to make sure, even just as best practice, you know, you want to make sure that if the idea if it's a good idea, it can travel into almost any media. So when you're doing that and then you come up with a really nice alternative thing, well, why wouldn't you present it, you know?
So we're sitting in a beautiful office here. You've a large number of staff. So how did you go from six to where we are here? So kind of bring me on that journey, say after the first 12 months, you've had a little bit of success. So I think that's the bit people, you know, a little bit of success is almost dangerous because I heard it on a podcast this week that mediocre is the worst place to be.
Yeah.
It's better to be a complete failure or a complete success.
Yeah.
So how did you tip past that and just blow to where you are today?
Well, I think I can't really remember when we decided we were kind of aligned. It was probably pretty early on. What we felt as if our point of differentiation in terms of the marketplace would be our overarching standard of creative. So, you know, when we looked around, we felt like the general standard was poor, but some agencies would have occasionally pull out a good piece of work for usually like a pet client. We felt as if, you know, if we could genuinely produce great work for all of our clients, that could become a kind of a point of distinction within for the agency. So you know, I think, you know, we started off with, say, the likes of John West and as I said, with Irish Distillers. You know, we got opportunities then with, we were very lucky actually to get an opportunity with Digicel over in the Caribbean. They were launching, I think at the time it was 4G. Their agency over in the States was struggling with it. Someone I'd worked with over there, you know, again, back to this network, rang us up in a absolute flap one day going, you know, okay, can you give us a hand of this? And we're like, absolutely, you know, we'd love to work with them. We'd loads of experience in telcos. And then we ended up, you know, producing a lot of work for them for 33 different markets, working with Usain Bolt, working the cricket team.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, you know, like, there was a bit of happenstance that, so like we worked with that kind of set of clients. You know, there was big wins along the way in terms of, like, you know, people like Dulux and Energia. And then I don't know, all of a sudden we kind of, I think to be fair, with, you know, winning Three Mobile back in the, I think it was very early 2013 was kind of a big one for us. They were, I think, fourth in the market at the time, but we kind of grew with them. They bought O2. We created a very good relationship with them, you know, again, based on those principles of kind of trust, partnership and a belief in creativity. And when they kind of grew, we kind of grew with them. And that gave us the ability to, you know, bring in other resources, you know, more digital resource, more in-house production, all that kind of stuff. And that led us to bring in more clients. And, you know, it's weird. I can't believe in many ways that we're coming into our 11th year. You know, it's really easy when I look at photographs of us, certainly myself, you know, the gray hairs tell a story. But
is it weird looking back now? You know, I find sometimes when I'm chatting to people on pod, sometimes as they're telling the story, I can see them kind of reliving bits, some good and some bad, yeah, as we're chatting to. Was there a moment where you're like, this is going to work?
We always thought it was going to work. You know, like, I suppose the one thing looking back or thinking back about it as I'm sitting here is we've been so bloody lucky in the people that have worked in the agency, you know, people that have come and gone and that are still here. Like, we've just worked with some really talented people. But again, I think the reason we were able to, you know, work with those talented people, because, you know, especially that time we couldn't pay market rates, you know, like there's other agencies around there who could just, you know, pay more for us. But we had that culture of the belief in, you know, the commercial power of creativity, and it was a really simple locus. So, you know, if you could attract like-minded people who just want to make great work, and there's a lot of people out there in terms of creatives and people in relationship management and strategy who are just, you know, if you create great work, there's so much more satisfaction there. So I think the agency really benefited on that. But yeah, we've been really, really lucky with the quality of people who've really, you know, got into working in Boys and Girls and working for our clients.
I think that's an interesting area, is attracting good people. I think a lot of people struggle with the hiring piece. They struggle, you often hear about, oh, the first two or three were fine, and then we struggled. You've kind of answered it already in terms of just do fantastic work and give people the vehicle to fully express themselves. But was that what attracted people?
I think so, yeah. Like, I think, look, it's we've never done a survey to kind of, you know, ask, well, sorry, we have HR and they do exit interviews and all that kind of stuff. And you know, so we do understand why people work. But I think, you know, it comes down to that kind of inherent culture that we've, you know, not necessarily designed, but it's part of the place, which is, you know, if we want to make great work. All the owners of the business still operate in the business. But it's still very, you know, flat hierarchical structure. You know, if you come up with a great idea for a client or not for a client, and bring it to us, you know, we'll support you. We'll invest in it. So there's a feeling of, I suppose, genuine camaraderie and cohesion that isn't necessarily replicated in a lot of places. And, you know, I think if you were to look at, you know, obviously people leave, right? Businesses for various different reasons, but we lose very few people to go to other agencies. You know, people might decide they want to move abroad, or there's a great girl who left us last week who decided she wants to be a doctor.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, like, you know, so you were, you know.
It's hard to argue with that one, to be fair.
Oh, my God, yeah. I was like, you are so clever and great and you're going to be brilliant. But yeah, so people tend to leave those things. But like, you know, we don't tend to lose too many people to our competitors. And I think it's probably because of that, I don't know, love of the kind of crazy spark that just occurs sometimes naturally in the agency. And I suppose that's why, remember we were talking at the start, why I really want to try and get back into a physical building, if only in a limited capacity, because whilst we've done brilliantly throughout this in terms of keeping the work going and keeping everyone going, I feel as if people need that kind of physical interaction 2 meters apart in order to kind of feed that culture.
Talk to me about that, because obviously you have a beautiful building here and you obviously have quite a few staff. So is it hard to be creative remotely? Is it hard when you're, how do you brainstorm? How do you get people together to thrash out ideas?
Yeah, well, I suppose, look, we've done a combination of things, but you know, as I said, because we had that kind of culture in place, I think it was probably easy for people to do it remotely when absolutely no one could kind of meet or go out. Now I think people are looking at kind of combination things. So, you know, I'm hearing that people are meeting up and going for walks in parks or grabbing a coffee and just walking around the canal or wherever else in small groups. You know, if and when they have a particularly difficult nut to crack. You know, there are certain occasions when, you know, just a chat in person will solve something, you know, several times quicker than you could over Zoom. And I'm not quite sure why that is. I haven't quite worked it out. Mm. But it's, I suppose it's, again, feeling and feeding off that kind of energy and being able to kind of bounce off and maneuver it, I think is a really important but under-recognized skill. And sometimes, you know, just coming into a project that might have just stalled a little bit, and given a little bit of a bit of your expertise or experience or just energy or encouragement can sometimes propel it in a way that it mightn't have otherwise gone to.
The serendipity isn't there. That moment whereby, okay, the meeting's over and now we're just sitting talking about the football or we're just talking about coffee or we're going out to get a coffee.
Yeah.
The serendipity isn't there. I chatted, you know, some of the podcasts are in person, some of the podcasts are on Zoom. And I said it to a friend of mine this morning. He was like, oh, how'd that podcast go on Zoom? I was like, yeah, it was great. But he wouldn't recognize me if he passed me in the street now. You know, there's that interaction is different. You know, you're in the 1 to 1, 1 to 1:15 slot on Zoom and there you go. And let's do our Zoom and off we go. And the calendar pop-up comes and it's very almost transactional.
Yeah, I think for me, and you know, when we come back, the kitchen's going to be closed, right? We have a kitchen here where people make food, and you know, we had set it up at the start, so there was always food in the agency. So when we started and we had no money, we could have lunch and breakfast, and we kept that going. But that kind of room for me is almost the most important creative room in the building, because you know, people talk about ideas or issues or problems or what do you think of this or what do you think of that, and yeah, like those serendipitous sparks or just, you know, hearing about a problem someone has and, you know, you're not even thinking about it and then you wake up the next morning and something's popped into your head and just being able to go over to their desk and, what do you think about this? Or that's a terrible idea because, or wow, actually, that is a really good idea. Yeah, I miss that.
Yeah, it's strange to be in empty offices. It's strange to see places empty. It's weird to be around town. What do you kind of like looking forward to the next kind of 3 to 6 months as things evolve? I'm asking you to predict the future now, which is always a tough one. So how do you see the next kind of 3 to 6 months playing out for you guys and in a broader context?
Well, look, I have been asking myself this question on a daily basis. I really don't know. Like my fear would be, you know, we're coming into winter in a situation whereby, you know, a common cold has a lot of the similar symptoms to something like COVID. And I think, you know, it's going to be a really tough, long winter. And I think that the likelihood of us having to go back to remote working or maybe not even getting back to the office, that's a possibility. But for us, we're just really trying to focus on our clients. You know, they've been struggling with, inverted commas, their new normals. And, you know, we've gone from that kind of stage at the start, which was, you know, reacting to the situation, coming up with lots of proactive ideas to actually, okay, well, there's where their business might have pivoted in a little way. How do we help support them? How can we support them in any way possible? And now they've got clear roadmaps, in terms of, you know, what they definitely need to deliver for the rest of the year. And we're just focusing on trying to deliver that. So it's, you know, I think, you know, we're in the process of looking at next year. What is it going to look like? You know, no one knows, but I think most people are predicting that the general economic conditions are not going to be superb. However, I...
That's a beautiful, soft way of putting it. I almost feel like it's going to be okay.
Yeah, well, look, again, coming into this sense of optimism, I think, you know, in any kind of situation like this, whilst it's maybe not necessarily a political correct thing, there's going to be opportunities. And, you know, like, if ever there was a time for people to produce marketing communications that work, that can have a positive effect on you, that are entertaining, that are going to resonate with people, it now is the bloody time. Because, you know, like, you don't need to be an expert in the history of business to know that great businesses start, grow and thrive in recessions. So, you know, you can pick, you know, any number of companies that have made their name or made hay when there are these kind of opportunities. And, you know, we want to make sure that as an agency, we're doing that. And we want to make sure that we're doing that on behalf of all of our clients.
Look, I agree. I've been saying that in the pod for 2 months or more. Just now is the time. You have to take that chance. You can't sit around and wait. A friend of mine put it beautifully. He's like, 2020 is either the year you sit back and feel sorry for yourself, or it's the year where you actually change things around and went, right, okay, I'm going to take charge. I'm going to pivot this. I'm going to try that. I'm going to do this. And it is, because time doesn't stop.
No.
You know, life goes on. You know, you have to move. And I think you've nailed it there in terms of people are looking for entertainment. They're looking to communicate. They're looking to reach out and feel something.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, that is a really important point, you know, in all of this. Obviously, when the economy and the society essentially shut down for that period of time, you know, one of the things that we possibly didn't consider was the effect that we as individuals, you know, that negative effect that we has on individuals in terms of the lack of social contact. And whilst communications can never replicate it, it can help to dissuade some of that kind of negative feeling or those sense of isolation. And, you know, producing a mode of work that's entertaining, you know, will have massive benefits. Like, again, if I even think just an example from our roster, we produced an ad during COVID, fully remotely, all that kind of stuff. But it's called Monster Hunter. It's about this story about this little boy, and you think he's been kind of told a story by his granddad, and the reveal is that it's done over the network.
I've seen that, and we actually, as we were watching it, I was like, I wonder how they shot that.
Yeah, so it was all done remotely. Like, we supplied the guys with iPhones, and, you know, we had a director, you know, working with them over the phone, telling them how to direct it. We had lit the scenes beforehand, so actually the lighting was kind of, if I roll back, you know, the brief for that, you know, could have easily ended up with one of those really, well, personally irritating ads now more than ever. You know, user generated stuff, people jumping up and down and doing all that kind of crappy looking material. But we said, no, we're going to produce something that looks as good as possible to the realms of our possibilities. And, you know, we worked with a production company and the client to really push it for we didn't end up spending like mega bucks, but it was putting in that time and effort. And the end result was an ad that's done amazingly well in terms of, you know, the brand. You know, we were sent footage of a priest at mass talking about the ad from a sermon. You know, it's the first ad that our creative director's dad has liked.
Really?
It's one of these ones that's just kind of exploded.
But it just, because we see so many ads, and it was one of those ads that was like, I kind of watched it and I was like, oh, I wonder how they did that. Because it kind of gets you, kind of follow the story, you get drawn in, and it's very difficult to do that.
But again, there's obviously this craft and a lot of thought and effort going into it. But, you know, I think it just shows if you're willing to push for great work, for entertaining work, you know, it just has much more of an effect. That could have been something that was literally on air for 2 weeks and disappeared.
Mm.
And here we are 4 months later, it's still producing the goods.
Do you always know what's going to be a hit, or sometimes you're like, oh wow, that actually, you're already smirking, that actually took off, I didn't think that was any good? Or
So more internally, like, so, you know, I've definitely been, you know, in a room whereby the creatives have gone, I have this idea, and I'm going, I just, like, sorry, I would pride myself in having a really good creative radar, but there's I think sometimes the particularly, like, way out there brilliant stuff just takes a day or so to kind of filter through you. Especially when it's I won't say strategically off brief, but maybe in how it's delivered. You know, so if someone says to you, you know, the way you said you wanted an ad for a rugby sponsorship, well, we're not going to do that. We're going to hand the sponsorship over to a homeless charity and make a 3-minute film that's going to go online. Okay? And you go, yeah, okay.
Right, okay.
You know, like, I don't know, like, I suppose one of the benefits of having a culture where, you know, centered around kind of creativity is that people are open to putting forward ideas. And, you know, I suppose sometimes if you don't feel a little bit uncomfortable, maybe it's not worthwhile.
Okay. That's interesting. What kind of, you know, we try and make the pod as practical as possible. So looking at kind of smaller businesses, you know, looking for the next 3 to 6 months, what kind of stuff would you tell them to kind of focus on and try promote in terms of their communications or their design or their strategy? It's quite a broad brief I've given you. But if you're just a small business, a 1 or 2 man operation, you know, you don't have a big agency behind you, what kind of stuff would you advise them to do well over the next 3 to 6 months?
Well, I think, look, it's interesting that you mentioned design there. I think that design is, for a small business like that, you might necessarily have a budget certainly won't have a budget for media spend. Look, if I was setting up as a new business, I would look at every piece of collateral that I needed to produce, like the stuff that might seem mundane, letterheads, signage for the door, the website, and to try and come up with a coherent thought or system that behind all those things are linked, and then spend as much money as possible as I could afford on the best design possible. Because if you can make it distinctive and memorable and different, and with that kind of little bit of thought involved in it, you can have a massive effect. So whether it's a coffee shop and, you know, you come up with an interesting name, but it's communicated in a personalized fashion through the coffee cup, you know, or a website that just utilizes brilliant copy and a color scheme to make it a little bit more distinctive. Anything that can make yourself distinctive and coherent idea around one core idea, I think it will make a massive difference.
That's really good advice. Yeah, I think design is, it's bad design is very obvious and good design is very obvious. It's just the middle is where you're like, and a new cafe.
And you know what? Like, good design will cost a little bit more, but not that much more. It is.
It stays with you forever. You have it forever.
Oh my God. Like, so that would definitely be where it'd be. And even, you know, when we started up, as I said to you, it was the little things. It was trying to have a name and a logo that looked, you know, differentiated. It was things like the Lego table or whatever, like little points of distinction. Are they the agency that, or that's the coffee shop with?
Yeah, think of that. What's that sentence?
Yeah.
They're the coffee shop that.
Yeah, like I saw someone posted online, there's a UK restaurant called Bob Ricard. It's in London and it sells more champagne than any other restaurant. And the reason behind it, it's so clever. And actually it's an ex-ad guy who has the restaurant. There's a little button in every booth, a little bell, and it says 3 words, ring for champagne, right? So you go and sit
love
in the booth,
that,
right?
Yeah.
You sit in a little booth, there's a bell. And
you want to press that button so bad.
Sorry, you are going to press that button. Like, you know, it's like Dougal in the plane.
Yeah, I was just going to say that, the red button.
Like, so you're going to press it and you know, it's this little clever prompt and it becomes part of the service design. You know, hit that, and like a 2-glass champagne or a bottle or a snipe or whatever it is. But what a brilliant idea. And I mean, the cost of that, minimal. But like from a differentiation perspective, the commercial result, like selling champagne is good business, right?
I love that. That little, Rory Sutherland talks about that in his book, Alchemy, I love that book. It's not about spending more money. It's just about thinking about things a little bit differently. Yeah. What's the joy? What's the enjoyment of it? We've all been to restaurants thousands and thousands of times. Oh, I went to this restaurant and this happened.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. What is that? It's just a little things. I can't remember who it was. I was reading, someone was looking for examples of, you know, what seemed... things that seem like, you know, a waste of a resource in terms of product design or packaging design. And San Pellegrino, you know, the way they've got the foil on the top.
Yeah.
I mean, okay, that piece of foil, you know, is, you know, it's probably small in terms of the scheme of things, but it's an easy thing to, you know, take off a balance sheet. But when you look at it, what does it signify? This product is different. Mm. It signifies freshness. It must be especially good fruit inside the can.
Yeah, it's fresh. Look, I'm peeling it off. It replicates the peeling of the fruit.
It's genius. Little touches. And again, that comes down, I think, to a lot of the stuff that's say in Adam Morgan's book, The Big Fish, which is just trying to come up with these little bits of differentiation or point of view that you can evoke through your product.
So you guys have still thrived during COVID. You still have done quite well. You popped up on my newsfeed just a couple of days ago.
Yeah, well, look, we were delighted. I think, you know, everything shut down on March the 12th, you know, we were all sent home and it was all a bit weird trying to get used to the remote working. And I got a very nice... phone call to ask us to tender or to pitch for the sponsorship of Chelsea Football Club over in the UK. So it's like a big global sponsorship. It was through 3UK. So again, our Irish client had managed to get us an opportunity there to pitch against Wieden and Kennedy, who in my view are one of the best agencies in the world. It had, like, in terms of, you know, drama, it had everything. A ridiculously short deadline, a massive sponsorship prize at the end of it, and all the difficulties of trying to do this remotely, working from, you know, my dining room, you know, your attic, whatever it was.
And it all happened during COVID.
The whole entire thing happened in COVID. Wow. In a period of about 2.5 weeks. So, like, you know, as I said, you know, we never knew how working creatively could work remotely, but it did. And I have to say, you know, we've done good pitches. It was one of the best ones we've ever done. And again, done remotely. You know, I was there in the tin of fruit in the dining.
Oh, really? You went whole hog?
Well, do you know what? Like, my view on it was, I'm going to treat this. We are going to treat this like the presentation is. It's one of the biggest presentations we've done as an agency. And just because we're doing it remotely, I want everything to be slick. And even, again, it was the little touches. It was making sure when we rehearsed it, that like every single handover was seamless. There wasn't any, I'm going to hand over to Jack, I'm now going to, it just worked brilliantly. And you know, look, we had a great strategic idea. We had a really good creative platform and we had a good team delivering in the room or in the virtual room.
So I'm kind of curious at how business had been operating. So you guys rehearsed it.
Well, sorry, we would tend to get to the state, like, I suppose one of the benefits of working together for a long time and you know, knowing how we all operate is we have kind of like a presentation groove, I would say. So and also given that amount of time, we you can't present stuff too much, but we got to the stage where we knew our roles pretty well, but you know, given it was such a quick turnaround, I mean, you know, you certainly weren't spending days in it. But yeah, I think just having that level of polish is important, and making sure, like, again, you know, comes into the little things. You know, there's no room for them to come into. You know, normally you'd have everything kind of laid out. You want to make sure that every bit of attention to detail from, you know, whatever you're giving them in terms of coffee and whatever food, all that kind of stuff is thought through, you know, maybe a personalized note or whatever else in front of the desk. You can't do that. So what's the next best thing you can do virtually? And it was just making sure that we were, I suppose, positive, energized and cohesive. That was the key thing. Mm. So yeah, we were lucky. We got a great result in the back of that, which we actually only were able to talk about as of last week. So we're delighted that's in the marketplace. And yeah, we've had a couple of other new business wins on as well. So yeah, it's been really, sorry, don't get me wrong, it's been a really tough period. in terms of, you know, trying to manage the business. You know, we have had business that's, you know, dissipated or declined over us, but like we've worked really bloody hard to try and keep as everyone in the business and to keep it going. And I think, you know, things are certainly looking very bright.
You've adapted quite well. I like that kind of mentality of, well, we're going to do it exactly well, like we would in the real world, treat it exactly like we would, leave nothing to chance. I've kind of watched some webinars and stuff, and it's, some of them have been terrible in terms of, oh, now here comes Pat, you there? Pat? It's just...
But nothing does my goat in. Like, there's been, you know, there's been a couple of instances where we've been, say, invited to speak at things or whatever else, and, you know, not having that kind of stuff just nailed down perfect signifies that you're not treating your audience with respect, I suppose from our perspective, if we've got a presentation, obviously there's technical things that can go down, your Wi-Fi can go down if you're doing a remote, all that kind of stuff. But you know, if someone's giving you an opportunity to present for their business, you want to make sure that you're giving, you know, the most professional and polished performance ever, because you know, if something is sloppy or ill thought through or there's a typo on the screen or any of that kind of stuff, it just signifies a lack of caring and a lack of attention to detail. And you know whilst that might not be the intention, that's how I think it resolves most. So you know, we want to showcase ourselves as being that polished and professional, and in doing so showcase that the amount of level of care we will give in presenting their business to the greater public.
Control the controllables. I like that.
Control the controllables. Yeah. But like, listen, having said that, you know, I've been in plenty of situations where, especially if you're not in your own premises, like you walk in and, oh, look, the screen is going wrong. So you need to be able to improvise as well. And I, you know, I might get a perverse bit of pleasure from that from time to time.
Comes back to the self-belief thing, I think, though. That comes back to knowing what you do is good.
Yeah.
I stand over this. This doesn't matter. If the screen goes down, it does not matter, because we stand over everything we're offering here.
Yeah, and experience, right? You know, so having had, you know, having gone into places and things not working, just be prepared for the worst. You know, it's like, it's the old Boy Scout motto. So, you know, like... You know, we're running out the door for presentations. It's like, okay, so we have run two laptops, yeah, a couple of keys. Have we emailed us somewhere that we can put on, you know, all that kind of stuff. And then if that all fails, then you just got to just roll with it, you know, like do your best sock puppets, you know, whatever you have to hand.
The backup of the backup of the backup. We're almost out of time. I just have two final questions for you. The last one is, I'm going to ask you to recommend a book so you can think about that for a couple of minutes. And the second last one is, then, influencers have kind of become a massive part of marketing and advertising. What's your kind of thought on the whole influencer space and where it's going?
I think that the influencer space is of particular interest for everyone at the moment, because you know, you can see that there are so many people out there with all of these hundreds and thousands of followers. My view would be to tread carefully on that. So I think, you know, think of these people as a media channel or some kind of sponsored partnership. So obviously you need to make sure that if you're working with an influencer, that there is no skeletons in the closet, something that's going to harm your brand. But even more fundamentally than that, you know, it's very easy for me to go out and buy 100,000 followers. You know, I can just do that overnight. So can you be sure that what you're buying is in someone's audience, is genuine people, and that your message is going to actually reach people rather than just harvested by bots in some click farm in China or India. So, you know, I would approach working with influencers with, you know, the correct level of professional rigor and cynicism. But I think there's a lot of really good ones out there. I'm not going to name names, but like, you know, there are some brilliant, brilliant people who've created their own personal brands. And
everyone's wondering who you're talking about now.
Well, I'm not going to name anyone, but there's a 10 that's immediately kind of come into my head. But just, you know, if something looks a bit too good to be true in terms of numbers, like, you know, I don't know if you follow, say, the Ad Contrarian, whatever else, who's, you know, he's definitely got some interesting stats, but, you know, like... if an influencer is got 300,000 views or sorry, 300,000 followers and is claiming a particular cohort, and you know, randomly ask 10 people, have you heard of them? And they say no. Mm. Okay, well, I don't know.
So every week we give away a book. We asked the guest, I just love books, so I just use it as my own little resource for finding new great books to read. Every week, give it away. All I have to do is tag Boys and Girls and tag myself to try win a copy. What book has had an impact on you personally or professionally?
Oh,
it can be anything.
The personal one is a good one. I thought about this a little bit more from a professional context. So, and you know, like you mentioned Alchemy, I really enjoyed that book. I think there's just so much great, thinking about how to think differently in particular circumstances. I really enjoy that. I recently read Eat Your Greens by Werner Schneiders, which is really good in terms of just creative effectiveness. But the book I return to, and I've already mentioned this from time to time, it's the one that's probably had the most effect on how I think about every opportunity and try how to maximize it, is Eat the Big Fish by Adam Morgan. He's the guy who coined the Challenger brand as a term.
He came up
with the whole set of rules as to, you know, how a Challenger brand might behave. But, it, you know, at its simplest, it's just looking at everything that you have, you know, every possible opportunity that you have as a business to interact with the customer and to make it the most effective marketing tool possible. So he's great, and I recommend you follow his he's got the website called The Challenger Project. They send out like a monthly email, and you hear about really interesting brands. Like, so the first time I heard about Tony's Chocolonely was on there. You know, there's loads of fascinating businesses that he either works with or has discovered. So I'd really recommend that book and their website.
Lovely. I love getting new resources. I've never heard of that. So that's brilliant. That's a great book. Pat, thank you so much. Where can people learn more about yourself and the company?
Well, if you go to boysandgirls.ie, that's our website. That's got, you know, a good representation of our work. And if you're interested in looking at me, don't Google the pictures from 2009, because those sideburns are ridiculous.
Pat, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Thanks, Gary.
And that was episode 69. I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. Do let me know. Share all feedback with me. You can get me across any social channel, Mr. Gary Fox. You'll also get me on MrGaryFox.com, where you can join our Monday newsletter, where I share the Idea Lab. And that's news, ideas, tips, tricks I've seen this week that have delivered value to me, and I share them with you on a Monday. There's a newsletter that goes out every Monday at 5 a.m. and there's also a 10-minute podcast that accompanies it. You can join up at MrGaryFox.com. I will see you back next week. Until then, have a great week.